Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. So one of the things that I think is very unique about Ayn Rand is her view that philosophy is everywhere. Philosophy is inescapable and it's crucial. That is, so much about our lives and about society, about government, is determined by what are sometimes seen as ivory tower issues in philosophy. And we live in an era that is very skeptical towards philosophy, and in part for good reasons, which is most philosophers are not talking about things very relevant to human life. But philosophy as a subject, the basic questions about the nature of knowledge, the nature of reality, the nature of good and evil, these are crucial, crucial questions in our life. And so I was really fascinated the other day when I saw an article pop up in my newsfeed from The Atlantic on the topic of free will. So The Atlantic is, you know, generally focused on political issues, economic issues, cultural, entertainment issues. It's intellectual, but it's not a lot of heavy lifting. So to see an article focused squarely on a subject like free will was pretty surprising. And then the other thing that was surprising is that this was, at least when I checked it, their most popular article. And it got quite a bit of attention. And I think it definitely deserves some discussion because, well, let me just share with you. Here's the title of the article. So it's by a philosopher, Stephen Cave. And the title is, "There's No Such Thing as Free Will." Subtitle, "But We're Better Off Believing in It Anyway." There's no such thing as free will. We're better off believing in it anyway. And there's a lot that is interesting in this article. I think one of the things that's most striking is that it's squarely focused on the practical consequences of philosophic ideas. As we'll see, it takes on this question of free will. Does it exist? But a lot of what's going on in the article is this question of, well, what happens if it doesn't? What are the implications to our lives of the truth about free will? The implications for us as individuals pursuing our own goals, our own values, and what are the implications for our for society, for a social system, for a political system? And in particular, this article is interesting because, as we're going to see, it really bears a lot on the inequality debate. So for those of you who don't know, Yaron and I co-authored a book that came out pretty recently, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. And what is really going to be fascinating is the way in which this debate over a 2,000-year-old issue in philosophy, do human beings have free will or not, really goes to the core of today's inequality debate, which we usually associate with economists, politicians, not exactly the people you expect to be writing dissertations on the question of volition. So let's dive right in. And the article basically argues that the science is in, the science is settled, we have a consensus, human beings do not have free will. Now, I mean, that is a monumental statement, first of all. I mean, this is a question that has been debated for 2,000 years, going back to the ancient Greeks. And yet what is fascinating is that it only takes Cave a few paragraphs, really, to say, all right, we've settled this debate. And then he's going to go on to say, all right, well, if people don't believe free will, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But I want to start in this segment by looking at his argument, what is the justification for this monumental statement, this huge claim that we don't have free will, the debate is over? And before I dive in, I should say a quick thank you to a couple people in philosophy I talked to. I don't even know if they want me to mention their names, but I will anyway, and I'll take the heat afterwards. I spoke to Ben Bayer and Aaron Smith, of the Ayn Rand Institute, both of them professors or doctors of philosophy, and their insight was really helpful in how to think about this. So if I say anything brilliant, it probably came from them. If I say anything wrong, don't blame them. It is almost certainly my own mistake. So that out of the way, what is this argument that free will doesn't exist? And in a word, it's science. We basically get a statement that scientists have really wiped the floor with any claim of free will. Here's how he starts this part of the argument. Quote, the sciences have grown steadily bolder in their claim that all human behavior can be explained through the clockwork laws of cause and effect. We'll come back to that particular quote because it is really revealing of where I think the author and many people who think about free will, particularly many scientists, go wrong. But first, let's look at the evidence that he uses to back up these claims. And his main focus is on evidence that comes from neuroscience, from people studying the brain and reaching conclusions about the mind. So he points out, after kind of giving some background on, you know, once the theory of evolution was on the table, we started to see that human beings are, you know, they're inheriting a certain genetic makeup, and scientists are discovering more and more ways in which our genetic makeup is going to bear on our behavior. You know, our genes are going to influence, say, our level of intelligence. Then later on, there's this debate about what role environment plays, and people arguing that environment shapes our behavior in all certain ways. And so the science becomes more and more debate about the things that can be explained in terms of your genes, and more things that can be explained in terms of your environment or your upbringing. And there becomes less and less room, he's saying, for free will. If we can explain human behavior in terms of these outside factors, then there's not much room for the inside factors. He thinks that we've really reached a point where we've definitively crossed the line into saying that you can't explain. There is no part of human behavior that is going to be up to your conscious decision making, to your free will decision making. And he starts by pointing out then that, look, we know that brain chemistry can change how we act. So if you take antipsychotics or even if you take drugs or alcohol, right, these things can change your brain chemistry and you're going to act differently. We know that changes in the brain structure can change how we act. He cites the example of adults becoming murderers after developing a brain tumor. And so he says, what science has been showing us is that, look, the brain is affected by our genetics. It's affected by our environment. And so there is just no reason that we can't explain everything about human behavior in terms of genes and environment. Now, you might think, okay, but that's not evidence against free will, right? And he says, and here he cites one particular scientist is giving the really definitive evidence against free will. And that's the work of American physiologist Benjamin Libet. So here's his quote on what Libet contributes. Quote, many scientists say that the American physiologist Benjamin Libet demonstrated in the 1980s that we have no free will. It was already known that electrical activity builds up in a person's brain before she, for example, moves her hand. Libet showed that this buildup occurs before the person consciously makes a decision to move. The conscious experience of deciding to act, which we usually associate with free will, appears to be an add-on, a post hoc reconstruction of events that occurs after the brain has already set the act in motion, unquote. And then he gets to the final conclusion of all this. Quote, the contemporary scientific image of human behavior is one of neurons firing, causing other neurons to fire, causing our thoughts and deeds in an unbroken chain that stretches back to our birth and beyond. In principle, we are therefore completely predictable. If we could understand any individual's brain architecture and chemistry well enough, we could, in theory, predict that individual's response to any given stimulus with 100% accuracy. Unquote. Now, in philosophy, this is what's called determinism. It's the idea that our actions are determined by factors outside of our control, that we don't have free will. You can think of the analogy of a forking path. You're walking through a forest, and free will says, well, you went that way, but you could have gone the other way. If we reconstructed the circumstances, which path you chose was not set in stone. And determinists say that is not the case, that there are no forking paths, that again, we could, if we knew enough about the brain, if we knew enough about the stimuli affecting you, we could predict with 100% certainty which path you would take, that if we replayed the universe 1,000 times, you would choose the same path. So how good is Cave's argument? Has science proved determinism true? Well, one thing that's interesting is that many philosophers don't think so, including philosophers who are determinists. So this is go back to 2014. Daniel Dennett, he's one of the most famous champions of determinism, and he has a famous book, Consciousness Explained, which one philosopher told me is mockingly referred to as Consciousness Explained Away. In any case, he reviews a book that was published by a philosopher named Alfred Miele, M-E-L-E, titled Free, Why Science Hasn't Disproved Free Will. And so according to Dennett, again, this is a guy who does not believe in free will. He's on the determinist side. He says, look, Miele has convincingly shown that if we examine the science that the determinists cite, if we look into these experiments like the Libet experiments, we can find interesting, potentially valuable knowledge. It's not that these experiments are, you know, junk experiments. But what we find is that they don't actually come anywhere near proving that determinism is true. Now, I've read Miele's book, highly recommend it. It's short. It's like 2 hours on Audible, just over 2 hours. And he does, I think he convincingly shows what's wrong with this claim that the science is settled and that free will is a myth. And I want to talk about the Libet experiments because I think it's really fascinating and helps see the kinds of mistakes that are made. Before I get to that, though, let's just go back to this basic starting point that can changes to the brain affect changes in behavior? Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that brain chemistry can create abnormalities that change the way people act. Changes in the brain structure, abnormalities in the brain structure can affect the way people act. One of the things that's frustrating about Cave's article is that for a philosopher, you'd think he would realize the importance of giving the other side's arguments, but he never actually gives us an argument for free will. He never tells us how the people who support free will would answer. But as somebody who does support free will, namely me, my first reaction is that's true. But the question of free will is not under any circumstances, can you do anything imaginable to the brain and will a person still have the ability to choose freely? It is with a normal functioning brain, does a person have choice? That's the real question. And part of what philosophy is interested in is, what is the nature of that choice? What do we mean when we say that people have choice? None of that is addressed. We just basically are going to start from this framework that science can explain all of our alleged choices. And then we get Libet, who's showing that actually we can track the brain. We can see that it's making decisions before people perceive themselves as making decisions. And therefore, we can conclude that the idea that we make free will decisions, totally delusional. So let's zoom in to Libet. So the way that this experiment worked, and I might get the details wrong, but basically what people are doing is they're staring at a clock. It's called a Libet clock, where the hand's going around and around pretty fast. And they're supposed to make a decision about when to flick the wrist. And they're not supposed to do so on any kind of objective basis. They're not supposed to create a formula. I will do it when the clock reaches X. No, it's just supposed to be arbitrarily flick your wrist and make a mental note of when you decided that you would flick your wrist at that time. And what they see is that when a person says, oh, I did it at, 2 minutes and 20 seconds or whatever the case may be, they see, the brain activity went off according to our EKG scanner. The brain activity went off, a few milliseconds or a few hundredths or thousandths of a second. I don't remember the exact numbers before they said that they perceived themselves making the decision. And Meehl puts out several problems with concluding from this that human beings don't have free will. And I just want to name the two that I think are really clear about why this is. You cannot leap from the conclusion that of what these experiments show to the conclusion that we don't have free will. So first is, what are the brain scans actually showing? We're told that they show the decision being made. But that is a completely arbitrary reading of what's going on. There's brain activity to be sure, but there's no reason to think that this represented a decision. It could very well represent brain activity that could lead to a decision. It's in effect brain activity that shows us preparing to make a decision. So the idea that we're seeing, it's not like there's a little D that pops up on the screen of, aha, decision now. It's just that there's this brain activity and it's an interpretation about, okay, what is that brain activity actually consisting of? Now, the second, this is really the most important point, is that Libet is generalizing his conclusions and saying that they apply to all intentional actions. So it's, we've done this experiment under these very definite circumstances, a decision about when to flick your wrist, and we're going to say that clearly now every kind of decision that a person makes must follow the same pattern. But it's a pretty unusual kind of decision, right? An arbitrary action to flick my wrist now rather than a second or two later or a minute or two later. And Meehl likens this to, you decide, all right, I'm gonna get some peanuts, a 16-ounce jar of peanuts at the grocery store. And then you go to the grocery store and you get there and there's, 20 jars and they're all the same. And so you decide for no particular reason to pick up this one rather than that one. It's totally arbitrary. And if you ask the person, well, why'd you pick that? I mean, their answer would be something like, I don't know. We're taking these kind of arbitrary decisions where nothing's at stake, where there's no deliberation, where it's in effect, well, I had an urge, I picked this one rather than that one. I flicked my wrist then rather than at a different time. But this is far different from most of the decisions we make in life, and certainly the decisions that philosophers who are talking about the issue of free will are interested in. What we're interested in is deliberative decisions, decisions where we're thinking about what to do over time and weighing pros and cons, projecting various things we might do and endorsing one and saying, yes, I'm going to go with this rather than that. I've been told, I don't know exactly what objectivist philosopher, it might have been Harry Binswanger, put it this way, but it's the idea that most what these kind of experiments show is that whims are not free, not that will is not free. That we would need a very different experiment to show that, for instance, when you sit at home and you go, all right, well, what kind of diet am I on? And what kind of food does that make for? And, oh, maybe I could have some peanuts. Yeah, I should buy some peanuts. Wait, am I allergic to peanuts? Are peanuts too caloric? I mean, that's the kind of decision making. It's thinking things through over time based on actual facts. That's the issue, is that that's the main issue we're interested in, right? Is do we have the ability as human beings to set purposes, to weigh evidence and to make actions accordingly, or are we puppets? It is far less interesting about can we make it's even unclear what that mean, right? Like, do I have free will about kind of an arbitrary, baseless decision that has no consequences? The bottom line that you get from Meehl, and he looks, like I said, at all the main current scientific claims. And Libet is basically the number one go-to resource for most of the people saying that science has disproved free will. So, I mean, CAVE is not unusual here. But Meehl goes through several other iterations of this. And the bottom line, I think, is that there's no scientific evidence disproving free will. And it's important to be clear, that's Meehl's claim too. He's not arguing, at least not in this book, that the science shows that there is free will. As we're going to see, that that's actually a philosophic, not a scientific issue, or not a special science. It's not one of the, not a question that can be answered by neuroscience, not a question that can be answered by the so-called social sciences. It turns out to be part of the science of philosophy, and that actually we can know philosophically whether or not we make choices. So I'm going to dive in a little bit to Ayn Rand's view of free will, her argument for free will. And here's the starting point. The fundamental, we can take a question like, am I going to eat peanuts or not? And one of the reasons that people would say, well, look, this is not a free will decision, is that you can give certain reasons why you chose peanuts versus something else. It's not something that you just willed, oh, I'm going to choose to eat peanuts. You're motivated by certain reasons and not by others. And if so, for instance, if you had a different diet, you might choose not to eat the peanuts. What we want to get is, what is our kind of, what is the root of our free will? If it's not just our blind ability to choose between having peanuts and not having peanuts, what is it? What is the fundamental choice, the choice over which we can directly will and directly control? And Ayn Rand thinks it's not a choice between two concrete actions, buy peanuts, not buy peanuts. It's actually a much more fundamental choice, a choice to either be aware of reality or not. The choice to think or not, or more specifically, at the root, she thinks we have a choice of to focus our minds or not. That the core of our free will is not to arbitrarily flick our wrists. It's not whether or not we're going to buy this or buy that. It is to set our minds to the goal of perceiving the world, of understanding the world, of grasping what is, or of not doing that. Of what she calls drifting. And we also have a third choice, she thinks, which is to actively and effortfully turn away from reality, to evade, to pretend that the facts are other than we believe them and know them to be. And so this idea of focus, it's a metaphor or an analogy, and it's an analogy to visual focus, right? It's that, you know, you're waking up and everything around you is kind of blurry. And but after a few minutes, your eyes come into focus. You can see things clearly. You can distinguish things more clearly. You're less likely to trip over things as you're walking because you can make out, oh, that's my child's toy, and you can walk around it. And her view is that something like this goes on at the level of thinking, at the level of ideas. Let's assume for a minute, and I don't believe this is possible, but let's assume for a minute that at some point during this episode, you found your mind wandering and you realize, oh, okay, I haven't been paying attention to what Don has been saying. That's your mind drifting, and you have the power, she thinks, to set it to focus, to say, no, I'm going to exercise effort to listen, to try to get as much out of what Don is saying, to think about, is it true or false? Is what he's saying about free will accurate, or is it unsupported, unjustified? Does it not make any sense? That, she thinks, is the core of your free will, to bring yourself out of that drifting state, out of that state where things are just kind of passing by you. You're not really focused on them too clearly and say, no, I'm going to try to understand reality. I'm going to try to understand and make sense of the world. I'm going to open my eyes, in effect. Her view is that this is something that you have control over, that whether or not you set your mind to that task of being in focus, that is not something that's imposed upon you. It's not something that is determined. At every moment, you have the ability to bring yourself into full awareness or to allow your mind to drop down to a lower level of awareness. And so what is the evidence for that? So if she thinks that's the core of our free will, what is her evidence? Well, for that, you're going to have to wait till after the commercial break. This is Don Watkins sitting for Iran, and we will be back in a minute.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Where will the next generation of principled intellectual leaders come from? ARI's Junior Fellows Program is designed to help students develop into tomorrow's intellectual leaders and provide a platform to participate in the world's most pressing debates. This is a unique opportunity for students to get paid while they work to turn their passion for Ayn Rand's pro-reason, pro-freedom ideas into a career. The last day to apply is June 15, 2016. To learn more, visit AynRand.org/JFP.
We're back at the Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. we are talking about free will and about this article in The Atlantic basically saying we don't have free will, but it'll be a disaster if people realize it. So if you want to get in the conversation, you can reach me on Twitter at dwatkins3. That's the number 3. And where we left off was getting to Ayn Rand's answer to the debate over free will. And her basic view is we have free will. It is the freedom to think or not, to use our minds or not, to set our minds to the task of grasping reality or not. And I describe the state that she refers to as focus, that is the full unconditional commitment to understand going on around us with the nature of reality, the facts, or our ability to let go, to let our awareness fall, to let reality kind of just pass by, as she put it, in a semi-conscious daze. And so what's her evidence for that? What is her argument that we have free will? And her basic answer is, it is self-evident. It's open to your direct awareness of your ability to control that state. That is, you can internally perceive yourself choosing to raise your level of awareness. And then that's all that's needed to justify free will. We have direct knowledge of our ability to either drift or to think or to push awareness of reality out, to deny it, to evade the facts. It is just as there's no argument for there's a microphone right in front of my mouth now. There's only, look, I can perceive it directly with my senses. By the same issue, there's no other argument for the existence of free will than my direct introspective perception that I can engage in this process of setting my mind to the task of understanding reality, or I cannot. So the question really is, why is free will viewed with so much skepticism, particularly among scientists? Now, set aside these particular experiments. The point is that there's been this longstanding bias against free will, especially by scientists. It's viewed as something kind of mystical. In effect, what you're trying to do in justifying free will is you're trying to say there's some mysterious force out there that is inconsistent with the rest of the laws of nature. And so you're on the defensive. You have the onus of proof. And if you're just going to say it's self-evident, well, who needs you? But the fact is self-evident. So the question is, what is the bias against it? And I think it goes back to this quote from the article that I started off with. Quote, "The sciences have grown steadily bolder in their claim that all human behavior can be explained through the clockwork laws of cause and effect." The clockwork laws of cause and effect. So most people believe that free will is tossing out the idea of cause and effect, that it contradicts the laws of cause and effect, that if you believe in free will, then you can't believe in the laws of cause and effect. And of course, scientists, their whole enterprise really is to understand the laws of cause and effect. It's to understand, it's to explain the things that we see around us in terms of their causes, in terms of their effects. And so if you're going to say, well, here's something that doesn't obey the law of cause and effect, a person can randomly do one thing or randomly do the other, and there's no causality to it, well, you are basically running in the face of science. Ayn Rand's view is that that is wrong. It actually comes from an unscientific view of causality. That is, it arbitrarily equates causality with mechanistic causality. It arbitrarily equates believing in cause and effect with believing that everything in the universe, including consciousness, operates through, quote, the clockwork laws of cause and effect. Now, there's two basic ways to think about causality. So one of them is actually goes back to the first thinkers who introduced this idea of causality, the Greeks. And their view of causality was that it's really the relationship between the nature of an entity and its actions. That what causality is saying is that the kind of thing an entity is, the kinds of properties it has, determines what potentialities it has. The identity of something determines what it can do, and it says that other things are off the table. The actions possible to an entity, in other words, and this is quoting Harry Binswanger from his really great book, How We Know, the actions possible to an entity are determined by its identity, by what it is, unquote. And as Dr. Binswanger points out, there's nothing in that understanding of causality that clashes with free will, that's against free will. There's nothing in that that says that a conscious being cannot have the power to, through his own choice, choose to raise his level of awareness or not, choose to think or not. Here's how Dr. Binswanger puts it. There's nothing in this proper understanding of causality that to clash with free will. Man, by virtue of his nature, has the potentiality of initiating a process of rational thought, but he does not have to actualize that potential. Unquote. The idea that free will and causality conflict, this is actually comes from a more recent version of causality, one that there's no reason to buy into. It's seeing cause and effect as a relationship between events. One event necessitates another event, necessitates another event, necessitates another event. And the standard example here is billiard balls. The motion of one billiard ball determines the motion of the next billiard ball. But again, this is actually an unscientific view of causality because there's no such things as free-floating events. Again, this is something that Dr. Binswanger points out. Like even billiard balls, their standard example of causality, what's relevant there is not the motion of the ball per se. It's the ball itself. It's that it's one ball crashing into another ball. That if you did that with water balloons, knocked one water balloon into another water balloon, the effect is going to be very different because of the nature of the entity that's acting. So that if you see causality as a relationship not between events, but between the nature of an entity and its actions, and you don't arbitrarily assume that the actions possible to a conscious entity have to mirror the actions possible to an unconscious matter, then there's no reason in the world to be prejudiced against free will. There's no reason to think that there's anything in the nature of cause and effect that would rule out or even render weird or bizarre that certain conscious organisms have the power to self-regulate their level of awareness. Because that's really what's going on. It's not that your choice to think or not is uncaused. It's caused by you. It's caused by you, the actor, choosing to raise your level of awareness. And this is something that was within your power, but was also within your power not to have done it. And anything else, any view that treats that as off the table as a prejudice view. It's not a commitment to causality. It's a bias in favor of one causality that we see in macroscopic material entities. On the contrary, far from being the scientific orientation, this is an example of being unscientific because what you're ruling out is something that is available self-evidently. So take, for instance, science relies on experiments. So if a person ruled out as I'm dubious about the validity of the senses, they cannot claim to be acting in the name of science because all scientific inquiry, all scientific experiment relies on the senses. To be scientific, you have to take the self-evident as the given. That's the material we work with. And so if just as a person denying the senses is being unscientific, a person denying another thing which is undeniable and introspective and self-evident, free will, is being unscientific. Now, that is the kind of metaphysical foundation of this article. It's do we have free will or not? And so I think Cave goes off the tracks from the beginning. In fact, there's kind of a flavor to this piece of almost the global warming debate, right? It's here's a contentious issue that people have been arguing about, but I'm going to step in and say the science is settled. And in fact, it's so settled, I don't even have to cite people who disagree with it. I don't have to give their arguments. I can just say there's a consensus and then be done with it. And then just as with the global warming debate, just as saying that there is this thing, global warming, and therefore we have to enact all sorts of different government proposals. Well, if there's this denial of free will, then we're going to be able to justify all sorts of political proposals that follow from that. But Cave is actually a little worried about this. He's worried about the implications of the non-existence of free will or the truth of determinism. He thinks that this very well could have some very bad consequences built right into his title, right? The subtitle, you know, there's no such thing as free will, but we're better off believing in it anyway. So Cave starts by pointing at to some really fascinating experiments that I hadn't heard about. Their conclusions aren't that surprising. It's kind of what you would predict from common sense, but nevertheless, they are interesting experiments that suggest that when people believe they're determined, when people believe they don't have any free will, they're less likely to act morally. And just to give one example, he cites a number of different experiments along these lines. These psychologists did an experiment. They had a group read a passage that basically said free will is an illusion. And then they had another control group just read, you know, a different passage that had nothing to do with free will. And then they had both groups take this math test where it was relatively easy to cheat. And it turns out that those who were primed to see free will as a myth, they cheated significantly more than the control group. And so, and Cave cites a number of experiments along these lines. And what he concludes is, this is how he puts it, quote, believing that free will is an illusion has been shown to make people less creative, less willing to learn from their mistakes, and less grateful towards one another. So he's pretty alarmed by that. He thinks, yeah, we should be pretty worried. And so the question is, well, what do we do? If we know the free will is a myth, and we have good reason to think that that myth actually leads to good consequences and that the truth would lead to really bad consequences, what in the world should we do? And that's really what the rest of his piece is examining. He basically introduces us to two scholars who are going to kind of evaluate whether or not what to do about this problem. So the first scholar he introduces us to says, yes, we don't have free will, and yes, the results of believing that could be disastrous. So what we need to do is basically we should not work too hard to tell the truth. Indeed, we should try to keep the truth from getting out too much. Only us trained experts in philosophy, us trained intellectuals can be allowed to know that there's no free will. It is, you know, free will is the opiate of the masses. It's the thing that's going to keep people under control. It's going to prevent this world where people aren't going to take responsibility seriously. They're not going to take morality seriously. We basically, he's a champion of what he calls illusionism. We have to keep alive this illusion that we have free will, even though in actual fact, we don't. Now, that's one view. The other view he turns to, and let me just say, I'm taking his summary of these other people's views at face value. We're going to talk about Sam Harris in a minute, and I know Sam Harris's work. I don't know his work on free will, so this could all very well be completely wrong. I just want to have that caveat because I think Sam Harris does some valuable work, and so I don't want to be critical of him not going through the process of actually reading his books. But the way his views are described in this article is that he is also an opponent of free will, but he thinks it's important that people grasp the truth in the issue. He never thinks it's good that people be given delusions. And he actually thinks that there would be good consequences in the world if we didn't believe in free will. And the example that is talked about in the article is think of our responses to 9/11 and then a short time later to Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, we didn't get mad and angry and declare war on hurricanes. We just dispassionately came up with better ways to to try to deal with these threats in the future. And he thinks that would have been good if we had not treated the 9/11 hijackers as evil. But we just said, all right, these guys are unlucky. You know, they were the victim of bad genes, bad upbringing, some combination of that. It's not their fault, but we still got to protect ourselves. So, all right, let's take a dispassionate approach to figuring out how to protect ourselves from Islamic terrorists. And Harris thinks this will make for a better society. Now, a couple things I just want to say at this point. This whole enterprise of debating what we should or shouldn't believe or what we should or shouldn't do about criminals, about the threat of free will getting out of the bag, all of that presupposes free will. There's no reason to deliberate over what we should do in the face of the non-existence of free will if we don't have free will. And now there's all sorts of rationalizations that you get even within this article about why, well, no, we can deliberate and make as if we can make choices. In the end, that is all nonsense. That is, if we don't have free will, then there's no reason to bother discussing, debating what we should do about it. Even though it's true that you can't consistently deny free will and talk about what people should or shouldn't do, what is true is that the denial of free will has moral implications. That is, this is not, if free will really truly did not exist, then there would be no issue of debating what we should or shouldn't do. But given that we do have free will, when people conclude that we don't, certain normative, certain claims about what we ought and ought not to do follow. Or to put it a different way yet again, those who deny free will, they tend to endorse a certain set of moral and political views. Views very differently from what you get if you recognize and accept free will. And I mean, you can see that in Harris just at a common sense level, right? His view is that there's no moral judgment that we can make against people who slaughter thousands of innocent people in the name of Islamic jihad. They're just like a hurricane. They just got unlucky. And so we don't need to punish them. We might need to kill them, you know, to keep them from killing us, the same way that, you know, you need to, if we could find some way to sprinkle some, you know, dust in the clouds and hurricanes, you know, you would do that. But notice that at the same time that you're no longer denouncing the bad, you're also not praising the good. There's no reason to champion or celebrate people like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Edison or any moral hero. They're not moral heroes. These guys are basically kind of good hurricanes, the kind of hurricanes that come and wipe out a bunch of, you know, threats. It is a complete wiping out of the distinction between good and evil. That is a really big moral change and a radical moral theory. I mean, it's an anti-moral theory. And so it predictably leads to, in morality, as we're going to see, what it really leads to endorsing is some form of egalitarianism, some form of we treat people equally, irrespective of their choices, because in the end, they don't really make choices. Let's see, though, how we get there, because this article actually builds up to this point nicely. So as we get to the end of the article, Cave is talking about the views of a philosopher, Bruce Waller. And Bruce Waller is what's known as a soft determinist. And it's not too important about the details of that, but the basic idea is he's still denying that we face this forking path and can choose one path rather than the other. But this is what Cave says. Waller's account of free will, in my terminology, just to interject, the denial of free will, and really anybody who denies free will. But he says, Waller's account of free will still leads to a very different view of justice and responsibility than most people hold today. No one has caused himself. No one chose his genes or the environment into which he was born. Therefore, no one bears ultimate responsibility for who he is and what he does. Waller told me he supported the sentiment of Barack Obama's 2002 You Didn't Build That speech, in which the president called attention to the external factors that helped bring about success. He was also not surprised that it drew such a sharp reaction from those who want to believe that they were the sole architects of their achievements. But he argues that we must accept that life outcomes are determined by disparities in nature and nurture, so we can take practical measures to remedy misfortune and help everyone to fulfill their potential. Unquote. This has actually become a big theme of Obama's, this idea that success is just a matter of luck. He recently gave a commencement address, and typically during commencement addresses, you're helping people celebrate an amazing achievement that they've graduated college, and you're helping prepare them for what they need to go out in the world and make something of their lives, giving them guidance on how to achieve the best, on how to be a good person. And it was during this commencement speech at Howard University that Obama thought it was really important to tell them that it's all a matter of luck, that even their graduating college is not something that they can take credit for. That was not their doing. Now, why? Why is somebody like Obama? Presidents are usually not particularly big on philosophy. Why is he so focused on this issue of there is no self-made man, it's all a matter of luck? Well, it's that Obama is an egalitarian. And the standard of this is really just the standard egalitarian view. So egalitarians, the people who believe in equality of all important things, particularly of economic outcomes, their view is that our outcomes in life, and above all our economic outcomes, they're not determined by our choices. They're determined by, Obama says, by outside factors, ultimately by luck. And even our work ethic, Rawls is explicit about this, because you might say, all right, yeah, some people are born with more money, some with less. Some people, parents give them more education, some with less. But come on, doesn't how hard we work at least play an important role? Even our work ethic, Rawls tells us, look, that is nature and nurture. If you had been born with different genes or to different parents, you might not have had a work ethic. Everything is ultimately determined by outside factors, by some combination of nature and nurture. So everything, all your outcomes are shaped at least in substantial part by luck. So the example that's often you'll hear today is, if you remember, Malcolm Gladwell put out a book a few years ago, I think in 2008, called Outliers. And he talks about the example of Bill Gates. And he says, look, everybody thinks, yeah, Bill Gates, he did this really great job creating Microsoft. But why was he able to create Microsoft? Well, it turns out that if we look at his history, he had access to computers before almost anybody else in the country did and was able to spend thousands and thousands of hours learning how to program. But he wasn't responsible for those computers being in the school. That was just luck. And absent that luck, he wouldn't have created Microsoft. And so to credit Bill Gates with creating Microsoft but for this fortunate circumstance, he wouldn't have been able to do it. He doesn't deserve credit for Microsoft, and he certainly doesn't deserve credit for doesn't deserve the billions of dollars he got by creating Microsoft. The broader issue is we don't deserve that according to the egalitarians. We don't deserve that which is not under our control. And since nothing is fully under our control, there's no such thing as deserve. There's no such thing as deserving something. And so what we want to do when we structure a society, when we create a society, is instead of rewarding desert, we need to minimize suffering. Instead of making sure people get what they deserve, nobody deserves anything, we need to minimize suffering. And basically we do that by forcing the lucky to subsidize the unlucky. And so I think you can see the connection to the inequality debate, right? The inequality critics want to level down society. They want to basically bring the people at the top down, force them to share the rewards with those who weren't so lucky. And on the face of it, that is unfair. On the face of it, I think most people feel uncomfortable about that. You're just going to take from people something that they earned and give it to those who didn't earn it? And egalitarians say, no. They didn't earn it. It was just all a matter of luck. We're all just lucky or unlucky. Our lives are determined by these factors outside of our control. We are not, in the end, free agents. And so this egalitarian program seems to be that, look, that's the moral solution. When you're dealing with the pawns of fate, why not make sure that we have as many pawns as possible, as well off as possible, or at least minimize how badly off they can become? And that's really the foundation of egalitarianism. It's the moral foundation of today's critics of inequality. When we get back, what's wrong with this view? What's wrong with the egalitarian argument? Is Obama right that success is just a matter of luck, and that a moral society is one in which we redistribute luck so as to minimize suffering? Stay tuned.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
ARI is now accepting applications for the Junior Fellows Program in Policy Research and Legal Studies. The program is designed for individuals who are seriously considering an intellectual career want to gain real-world experience and training, and are interested in the application of objectivism to policy issues. The application deadline is June 15, 2016. To learn more, visit ayinrand.org/JFP.
Welcome back to the Yaron Brook Show. This is Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. We are talking about free will and how the denial of free will is really underpinning today's inequality critique, the inequality campaign. And before we came back, we were talking about the way in which the basic argument is the inequality critics, they want to take a bunch of money that people earn. In order to justify that, part of what they do is they try to say nobody earns anything. Why? Because a lot of what you get is out of your control. Indeed, everything you get is out of your control, because whether it's being born to rich parents, whether it's being born with more intelligence, whether it's being born with a bigger work ethic, everything that goes into you creating wealth is not something that was under your control, not something that was under your choice. And if we wipe out the existence of choice, well, then there's no basis for saying that one person deserves more than others. And so instead of a society that protects people's right to what they earn, that says you deserve what you earn and the government's there to protect it, what we need to do is have a society where we try to minimize human suffering by taking those who are the beneficiaries of good luck and basically saying we're going to penalize you in order to reward those who have inherited or suffered through bad luck. And notice, by the way, notice that they're completely wiping out any moral judgments by denying choice. There's no conception of, well, guess what? Some people, the reason they fail is because they're liars, they're cheats, they're lazy, they don't do anything productive. That may be, but we can't pass a moral judgment on that, because after all, just like the hijackers at 9/11, they inherited some bad genes, they had a bad environment. What are you going to do? That's the moral foundation, such as it is, that's behind the inequality critique. But what's wrong with it? Because we can't just point out that it's vicious. You have to actually be able to answer what is wrong with that. Now, in Equal is Unfair, the book that Yaron and I wrote on this topic, we go into some depth on just this issue. I want to highlight a few aspects about it here. Now, first of all, true, there's a substantial amount of luck in life. Some people do start with so-called privileges or more privileges than others. There's no question about that. There's no question that Bill Gates really did have an advantage that many other people didn't. He had computers when others didn't, among other things. Now, I should also say this: the role of luck is massively exaggerated by egalitarians. Some of them are outright determinists. Some of them are just implicit determinists. But this idea that even your work ethic is not a product of you making a decision every day to work hard, but it's somehow something you inherit from your genes and environment, I think is complete nonsense. But nevertheless, it's true. Luck is significant. You're going to encounter it. But do they draw the right conclusions from that? Let me take an example I got from Dr. Ben Baer. Again, he's a philosopher who said he used this example in class, and I love this so much that I had to shamelessly steal it. Alice shrugged. You have James and Dagny Taggart, brother and sister. Two very, very privileged kids, right? They're born rich. Their dad runs Taggart Transcontinental Railroad, one of the most successful railroads in America. But they start out with the same privileges, and indeed, Dagny, being a woman, arguably starts out with fewer, but they seem to deserve very different things. James is a liar. He doesn't want to exert any effort. He doesn't want to take any responsibility for running the railroad. He basically becomes head of the railroad because he's really good at schmoozing and manipulating people. To the extent he makes any money, it's through getting special favors from his friends in Washington, often at the expense of genuinely productive people. He blames Dagny for any failure, even if it's his failure, when he can get away with it. He takes credit for her achievements when he can. Dagny, on the other hand, is somebody who takes responsibility, who works tirelessly to keep the railroad running, who, I mean, basically works herself to the breaking point to save an entire state, Colorado, by providing it with a railroad when it's desperately needed. And so even though they have the same shared background, it seems that they deserve different things. And why would that be? Well, because they make different kinds of choices. Good luck and bad luck, in other words, they constitute the background against which we make choices. But it's only with regards to our choices that justice comes in. To go to the Bill Gates example again, it's neither just nor unjust that Bill Gates had access to computers when other people didn't. He had access to them, they didn't. What becomes just, where justice enters the picture, is focusing on what should we make of the choices he made given that he did have those computers. What did he do? Well, he made really good choices with really good results. He made choices, the results of which led to the creation of enormous economic value. Bill Gates wasn't the only person in his school, and his school wasn't the only school with computers. How many kids spent, I mean, literally day and night in the computer lab learning to program? How many other kids were looking for other jobs where they could program? How many other kids were pouring through textbooks and asking questions and really giving everything within their power to learn this skill? Let alone how many other people quit school to start a company? How many others figured out how to come up with a deal with IBM that ultimately allowed them to own an operating system, which, you know, grew into the most successful operating system in the world? It was he who was making these choices in the face of a lot of things that were not under his control. And what justice is concerned with is evaluating those choices and the results, the consequences that flow from those choices. From the perspective of choice, from the perspective of free will and judging people's choices and their consequences, he deserves the values he's earned as a result of his choices. Bill Gates deserves billions, not because he got lucky, nor does the fact that he got lucky strip him of the right to those consequences. It was the fact that, given the circumstances he encountered, he actually did make the choices necessary to build Microsoft, which billions of people spent a lot of money because they valued it. He deserves that fortune as a result. Now you might ask, but wait, look, wouldn't he created far less economic value if his luck had been different? If he hadn't had those computers, if IBM hadn't agreed to the deal that it agreed to, he would not have created billions of dollars in value, right? Yeah, sure. But that's irrelevant. What we're entitled to, what we have a moral right to, is completely unaffected by our ability to imagine scenarios where we would have done things differently. I mean, you could just as well do the same thing, you know, with the hijackers on 9/11, to go back to that example, right? It's, look, if they were born in a different country, if they were born 2,000 years ago before there were airplanes, if, you know, their DNA had been different, maybe they wouldn't have committed that crime. Maybe so. But what justice is concerned with is not your decision under one set of circumstances with your decision completely different imagined circumstances. What justice is concerned with is you are acting in the face of certain circumstances, many of which are not the result of your choices, and you could have done certain things and you could have done other things. You could have made better choices. You could have made worse choices. What choices did you make and what were the actual results? That's the only thing that's relevant. The egalitarians, where they go wrong here, I mean, they go wrong all over the place, but the real crux of their error in this particular scenario is a false standard of what it means to earn something. So to earn something for them means to have created ex nihilo. It's not enough that you took certain actions that led to a certain result when you could have done otherwise. For them, it's you had to be responsible for everything that went into that result, including your own genetic makeup. including your own environment, including your own parents. In fact, they have this kind of that they'll often use of, the best way to get ahead in life is to choose the right parents. But that is really just revealing the bankruptcy of their standard. It's an irrational standard. We need concepts like earn and deserve, not to distinguish those who create their brains or choose good parents from those who don't. That's a fantasy. That never happens, right? What we need those concepts for is to distinguish people who, faced with a given set of circumstances, have to choose between alternatives and can make better or worse choices. And the egalitarian system, then, that they build on top of this false foundation, their system is, unsurprisingly, really unjust. It disregards, it throws out people's different choices. It says we don't have to consider what people choose in laying out how they should be treated, either because they don't choose anything or because their choices are irrelevant because it's swamped out by luck. Ultimately, it's a denial of the importance, if not the existence, of choice. It says we can throw all that out and we can figure out what the just way to treat people is. Well, but what does that result in? It results in penalizing good people who've done nothing wrong because they allegedly experienced good luck. And it demands rewarding bad people, as well as good but unlucky people who have not been wronged. So, for instance, it says if you are poor because basically, you know, you decided to become a gang member, a drug dealer, and you're not very good at it, and you're not willing to show him work at time, you're not willing to actually go to school and learn anything, you're a liar, a scoundrel, and nobody would employ you anyway, you're entitled to what Bill Gates created, because Bill Gates allegedly is just a lucky guy. We're going to punish Bill Gates in order to reward you. Or to take the more sympathetic case, you can imagine a person who's simply born maybe to poor parents, maybe with a learning disability, somebody who starts a business and it's, you know, wiped out by a tornado and, you know, their insurance hadn't quite gone through yet. Like, you can paint whatever scenarios. Those people might be the recipients of bad luck, and we can feel sympathy for them and we can choose to help them. But what the egalitarians say is, no, what we're going to do is penalize people who've done nothing wrong, and to reward these people who have not been wronged. Their experience was unfortunate, but it wasn't unfair, since unfairness has to do with how one person treats another. The bottom line, then, is that the egalitarians are wiping out the importance and reality of human choice and trying to say what a moral society would consist of if we ignore the whole phenomenon of choice. Yet choice is at the crux of morality. And so you can't come up with a moral system by evading and ignoring the ramifications of people's ability to make choices. In fact, what a just system is, set aside the egalitarians, a just system is one that protects our rights so that we're free to make good choices and to benefit from the results. And by necessity, therefore, we're free to make bad choices and experience the consequences of those results. An egalitarian system is one in which, guess what, we get to inflict the consequences of our bad decisions on those who've made good decisions. We get to prevent people from making good decisions by taking away their autonomy and taking away their freedom. It is insulating people from bad decisions and barring people from benefiting from good decisions. Let me sum things up this way. Free will is real, and the denial of free will is actually unscientific. Whatever you can say about the state of science today, there's nothing, not one thing, that casts doubt on the existence of free will. And if you deny free will anyway, the results will be disastrous. People who don't believe in free will make worse choices on the whole. And a social system based on a denial of free will by necessity be unjust. I think there's a lot more to say on all of these issues. Definitely check out Equals Unfair. We don't go into the issue of free will too much directly. We do go into this luck issue in quite a bit of depth, and address a whole bunch of associated issues about the kind of effects of an egalitarian system and other aspects of the immorality of egalitarianism. But on the free will issue, a couple of resources I want to recommend. I think these are just fabulous, fabulous things to check out. A couple books. So first of all, there's a collection edited by Robert Mayhew called Essays on Ayn Rand's Anthem. And in there, my colleague Ankar Gatte has an essay on the connection between determinism and dictatorship. And so I highly encourage you to check that out and read it. I think it is really insightful on just the issues we've been talking about. I didn't even think of this, but in another Mayhew collection, Essays on Ayn Rand's We the Living, Ankar has another essay on the nature of evil, where again he makes a connection between egalitarianism and shows how egalitarianism is unjust. So that's worth checking out. Yeah, finally, one more from Ankar. This is in the really incredible must-read collection edited by Alan Godhelf and Gregory Salmieri, the Blackwell Companion to Ayn Rand, where Ankar has a piece on Ayn Rand's ideas, man as a being of self-made soul, which takes a really interesting look at her views on free will and how they connect to her views in morality. Finally, another recent book, pretty recent, came out by Dr. Harry Binswanger, How We Know, which has a whole appendix on free will and a really excellent summary of a lot of these issues and everything from what Ayn Rand means by focus, the way that that choice relates to all the other choices that we make, about this idea that causality is somehow in conflict with free will. Definitely check that out. And a couple courses from the Ayn Rand bookstore, which you can find on our website, the e-store. Ben Bayer, I mentioned a couple times, who kindly answered a bunch of questions that I had. He is just a really, really good course called A Brief History of the Concept of Free Will. And he really looks at the historic debate among philosophers about free will. And I found that to be one of the most fascinating, clarifying things in this issue that I've heard. It really addresses a lot of the philosophic arguments, which we haven't really touched on, against free will. And it also addresses, I mentioned this idea of soft determinism, or the broader issue of compatibilism, which says that, look, we can reject, we can believe in determinism and free will. If that sounds weird to you, it is weird, but Ben's course will help you make sense of it and what's wrong with it. And finally, another, this is from Harry Binswanger as well. He has a course called Free Will, but the one I actually like even more and cover stuff that isn't in his book is a course called Free Will and Values. So definitely check all those things out. We're going to take one more quick break, and when we get back, I'm going to use my free will to end on a positive, why I love Ayn Rand's novel, We the Living.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at aynrand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit aynrand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to aynrand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at aynrand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, why should we care? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn. And the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Where will the next generation of principled intellectual leaders come from? ARI's Junior Fellows Program is designed to help students develop into tomorrow's intellectual leaders and provide a platform to participate in the world's most pressing debates. This is a unique opportunity for students to get paid while they work to turn their passion for Ayn Rand's pro-reason, pro-freedom ideas into a career. The last day to apply is June 15, 2016. To learn more, visit aynrand.org/JFP.
Welcome back to the Yaron Brook Show, our final segment. This is Dom Watkins, by the way, sitting in for your own book. Although if you didn't know that by now, why are you just tuning in at the very end? Anyway, why I love We the Living. So We the Living was Ayn Rand's first novel. And I do have an embarrassing confession, which is I came to work at the Ayn Rand Institute a decade ago. And I had, by that point, been an objectivist for almost a decade. And I had not read We the Living. In fact, I didn't read it for probably another 2 years. And in my defense, I don't read a lot of fiction, and I couldn't pronounce the Russian names, which made it hard to remember who the characters were. Nevertheless, I did finally read it. It's without giving away, it is in many ways one of the most tragic of Ayn Rand's novels, and in that sense, a hard read. But it is also just an incredible story, and I mean, really tension-filled, beautiful, and it tackles, as with all of her novels, important themes. In this case, it's man versus the state. And in particular, what we see in We the Living is what a dictatorship, not just communism, but any dictatorship, what the role of, as she puts it, what the rule of brute force does to men and how it destroys the best. And this whole focus on the best individuals, this is very characteristic of Ayn Rand, that she's concerned with human ability and above all, those with the greatest of ability. And her view is that the most immoral thing about dictatorial social systems is that it crushes the best in human beings, the most moral, the most able human beings, worst of all. And in this sense, We the Living is what I've called, and I have a blog post on this, Ayn Rand's anti-egalitarian novel. Now, in the end, all her novels are anti-egalitarian, but this one is anti-egalitarian in a more direct sense. That is, Marxism is a form of egalitarianism. It's the idea we are basically going to, because nobody's better than anybody else, nobody deserves more than anybody else, we're going to make society equal. We're going to redistribute wealth from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And what we see in We the Living is this question of, is this a benevolent ideal gone wrong, or is this an evil ideal? And part of what's at stake is the question of, can a person committed to equality be motivated by lifting everyone up to the high level of the highest? And is that what a dictatorship can do? Or is a dictatorship really, and is egalitarianism really, about bringing everybody down to the lowest common denominator? And the argument in We the Living is precisely that the truth about egalitarianism is to tear down, to level people down. That this is really the motivation behind every dictatorship, is power lusters who are motivated by hatred of ability. And let me quote from my colleague Ankar Gatte again once more. This is from that essay in We the Living, or in essays on Ayn Rand's We the Living that I mentioned in the last segment. He says, quote, Rand, when analyzing the left years later, that is years after writing We the Living, commented that the goal of equal prosperity for all gave superficial plausibility to the ideology of collectivism. If Andre's error in being seduced by communism is an honest error, as the novel portrays it to be, then this superficial plausibility is a significant part of the explanation. But the fact remains that the egalitarianism at the heart of collectivism cannot and is not meant to lift people up. As Ayn Rand wrote more than 30 years after publishing We the Living, equality of results as opposed to equality of individual rights before the law could be achieved in only two ways, either by raising all men to the mountaintop or by raising the mountains. The first method, however, is metaphysically impossible, since individuals have different attributes and abilities and make different choices. So the only actual meaning of a crusade of equality of results is a crusade to level society by pulverizing the mountains. Not surprisingly, therefore, this is what is portrayed in page after page of We the Living, unquote. So definitely check out my blog post on this at ari.aynrand.org/blog. And check out We the Living. This is actually the 80th anniversary. And stay tuned. We're going to be talking about our New York fundraising dinner not too long in the future. And there'll be a really amazing item available for auction there related to We the Living. The other thing about the novel that I really like is that Ayn Rand wrote it when she still considered herself learning how to be an artist, developing her own voice. And one of the really fascinating things is, of course, you probably know her favorite novelist was Victor Hugo. And one of the really fascinating and kind of touching things in the novel is that you'll read certain passages. I have in mind one particular description of St. Petersburg in the book that read like straight out of Hugo. But you also get to see the kind of earliest development of her own unique, distinctive voice. And from that perspective, just seeing the growth of Ayn Rand, a real treat. So with that, we are done with the Iran Brook Show for the week. Follow us online. You can reach me on Twitter at DWatkins3. That's at DWatkins3. And we will be back next time with another episode of the Iran Brook Show. This is Don Watkins. See ya then. For what is a man?
what has he got? If not himself, then he's